How was your Thanksgiving?
It was good. And I think, yeah, it was nice. It was pretty chill. I felt like I had lots of time to prepare for it and stuff, and I didn't feel like it was rushed or anything. So it was fun. But we can maybe talk about that as sort of like the main part of the show. But
okay,
at my Thanksgiving dinner, my sister-in-law was trying to describe the flavor of beets to someone, and she called them earthy.
Is a trigger word for you?
I mean, I wouldn't call it a trigger word. I don't really get emotional about it, but I do sort of have a bit of a, I don't know how to describe it. Like I don't like the word, and I don't think it's accurate. Mm-hmm. Maybe I have a little bit of a vendetta against it. Maybe I want it removed from the culinary lexicon as like an overused descriptive word for flavors that people can't put their finger on.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. We were talking about it, and she was like, "Oh, well." She was talking about it with someone else, and she said that they taste earthy. And then she asked me. She was like, "Right, Shale? Like they taste earthy, right? Like they taste like dirt." And two things, like, if you mean, if the word earthy to the person who's using it means that something tastes like dirt, I mean, dirt definitely has a flavor. So
yes,
that's legit, you know, like, if you're using the word earthy to describe something that tastes like dirt, then I think it makes sense. Mm-hmm. The problem that I feel like I run into cognitively when I'm hearing someone describe something as earthy is that I don't think that there's food that tastes like dirt.
Right.
You know, like dirt tastes really, really earthy.
That's true.
No, I mean, like, it tastes bad. And it's, like, not just the flavor, but the texture is obviously also horrible. But I don't think, like, I think that if food actually tasted like dirt, people wouldn't eat it, you know? Like, people wouldn't enjoy eating that food. And that's so I don't think it's really a valid descriptor. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, generally, I agree with you. I will say, like, there is some, oftentimes if I have beets in a bag and I open the bag, there is something that, I don't know if it's the vegetable itself or how like our market forms of it or what, but like the aroma of the raw beets does tend to remind me more of dirt than other vegetables that grow in the ground, like potatoes and carrots and stuff.
Okay.
Is that fair?
Yeah. I think that's totally valid. I totally agree with that. I don't think that that aroma really transfers over to their flavor once you've like, if you peeled them and you're going to put them raw in a salad, or if you've roasted them and taken the skins off, like maybe there's like a tiny bit of that aroma that's still detectable, but I don't think the flavor of beets tastes like that aroma of dirt that you're describing. I do think that you're right. Like if you open a bag of beets, and especially if they've, you know, come from the garden and you've washed them yourself, like, and didn't buy them like already, I don't know, chemically bleached or whatever from the grocery store. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. The aroma of dirt for sure.
Yeah. And to try and be a little bit more specific about that, like that aroma, it is obviously it's literally earthy because it is earth, but I mean like it's more like a kind of like mineral, or even like sometimes it reminds me of mold a little bit, like a kind of like cellar, moldy cellar kind of smell. But yeah, I generally don't taste that in beets. Right. I think the big thing is like, yeah, earthy as a placeholder for a je ne sais pas kind of thing. Like, and oftentimes it's like they definitely don't literally mean that it tastes like dirt. Would you say that it's more like people use it for like a certain depth of savoriness sometimes, which is an odd, it's an odd word for that.
Yeah. I think that's part of it. Not an umami type of savoriness, but like yeah, to me, I think where it comes up most often is in cases where it's something that has like a savoriness that comes from minerality. Mm-hmm. And I think that beets definitely have that. Like they mm-hmm. taste minerally. The best sort of like thing that I could come up with to describe the aspect of the flavor of beets that I think people might equate with the word earthiness is like a minerality that's similar to Flintstone vitamins. Do you eat Flintstone vitamins when you were a kid?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Do you think that there's any of that flavor in beets? It reminds me of it for some reason. I don't exactly know why.
I never would have put that together, and perhaps it's just the power of suggestion, but I think I maybe know what you mean.
Because they're flavored like fruit as well.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of it. Like they're, you can taste that they're very minerally, but mm-hmm. then they also have this kind of like fruit flavor and sweetness
yeah.
that's like over top of that. And I think that beets have that, like they taste a lot like minerals, but they also have a lot of sweetness and kind of fruitiness to them.
And maybe, is it fair to say that both beets and Flintstone vitamins have the ever so slightest bitterness on the finish sometimes?
Oh yeah, for sure. I can see that for sure.
Wait a minute,
yeah.
First of all, what flavor of Flintstone vitamin are we talking about here? Because there's three.
Oh my God. My memory of Flintstone vitamins is not ready to answer this questionnaire.
I remember I hated the purple ones. And probably because we talked about my love of, as a child, of orange Triminic,
right?
That I really liked the orange Flintstone vitamins. So I'd leave the purple and red ones for my brother and sister.
Yeah, I honestly don't remember having a preference. And like we did take vitamins when I was a kid, but I don't think we always had Flintstone vitamins at home. But at my grandma's house, I remember that we used to take them. So maybe I didn't take them enough to develop that preference or right. to remember what my preference was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It wasn't like a daily thing. So, yeah, we took other vitamins daily.
And also the Fred ones tasted way different than the Barney ones.
Oh, I'll bet they did.
Even if they were the same color.
Tasted way more annoying. Yeah, so anyway, earthy, I don't know. I think it's an invalid descriptor. I don't think it's specific enough. I think it's a placeholder, like you said, for a group of flavors that are difficult to put your finger on and difficult to like make a comparative sort of case for your sense memory to like to equate them with the flavor right. of something else that you can then sort of like hang your hat on as to what they are similar to if you're trying to describe them to someone.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also feel the same way about the word gamey.
Oh yeah, that one's just, well, that one as a descriptor is much more useful and valid, but it's just so widely misused or misunderstood.
Yeah,
we've kind of, like, there's definitely meat.
Yeah, we've talked about that one before.
Yeah, like it tastes gamey. That's a thing. But the way, like, when people are talking about like farmed bison is too gamey for them, it's like I bet that in a blind taste test, like, most people couldn't taste the difference between farmed bison and beef, like if it's lean
right.
lean meat. So I think that one's
what's interesting there too is that, like, I think that I might be able to tell the difference between those two things, like mm-hmm. in a similar cut. You know, like
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
if it's two pieces of like non-working muscle, like if it's two ribeyes like side by side or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to make, I know you're not really a Seinfeld guy, but I'm going to make the candy lineup that George made with Twix bars. I'm going to do that for you with red meat.
Yeah. I what I'm working up to.
Sorry.
is that I think that like maybe... Also, that represents mineraliness or like minerality.
Sorry. That's okay. Yeah, that's possible, I think.
You know, like, I think that I might be able to taste the difference because I think that in a lot of cases, meat from animals that aren't just like farm-raised cattle or whatever tend to have like more iron, tend to taste more like iron. than just like farm raised cattle. But yeah, I would like to do a side by side because I wonder if that's just me making that up, you know?
Like, yeah. Yeah. I don't know if it would be so much of it, like my associations with it. I think we've talked about this before. Like I find that proper pastured lamb, like not grain finished, like entirely pastured lamb.
Yeah.
Has a really similar, like if say I'm making stock from lamb bones like that, it smells exactly as if I'm making stock from true wild game, like mule deer and
right.
whitetail. And I don't know what the actual like compounds or whatever that are at work, but yeah, something very, the aroma of the cooked stock and meat is very different than
just like farmed a regular grain fed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, definitely. I think that if you put like a piece of, you know, farm raised grain finished meat on a plate beside a like grass fed pastured piece of meat of any animal, it might taste very much different than say like beef and bison who were fed the same diet.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
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 Yeah, I definitely think that that's probably true. Diet, I'm sure, has a lot more to do with the, with like the final flavor of the meat than necessarily like what the species of animal is.
But it kind of like just the word gamey is just like a way for people to. It's an easy out for them to when they just don't want to try something new or don't particularly like it. They say, "Oh yeah, it's too gamey."
Yeah. Which is unfortunate, I think, but I don't know. I guess it's just the way it is. I don't begrudge people wanting an easy out for trying things that they don't necessarily like. Like, yeah. I like to try everything as much as I can stomach it because I'm curious about flavors specifically and things like that. But I understand if that's not people's jam and they don't want to put stuff that they're not going to like in their on their tongue. Like, I get it. Mm-hmm. I'm a different person, and if the word earthy or gamey you know helps someone justify to themselves why they don't really want to try something or something, like, yeah, that's an excellent use for it, then I would say.
But. And the other one that is like totally valid as a descriptor but is often used as a je ne sais quoi is floral. There's obviously things that smell floral, but sometimes people use it when it like, Do you mean that it literally smells like flowers, or is there just something going on that maybe you can't,
quite describe or whatever? Yeah, I think that's true too. I'm guilty of that sometimes. Although I also am like, I'm also surprised at how many things that I smell that actually do taste, that actually do smell like flowers.
Oh yeah.
In some way. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's like the aroma of flowers. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I mean, but then there's a lot of different flower aromas too. So it's like kind of complicated, but
I have no idea whose turn it is to do the intro. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sutterby and I'm here with my good friend, Shale McDonald. Hi, Shale.
Hey, Alan.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it.
Yeah. So, do we have any follow-up today, Alan?
Probably. I have two quick pieces of follow-up.
One is
that in the last episode about Cook's Camp, I totally butchered the name of a restaurant in Vancouver. I called it Mame.
Oh, okay.
But it's Mae Nam.
Oh, okay.
A really great Thai-inspired restaurant that I think it was named like best restaurant in Vancouver circa 2016 or something, but it's Mae Nam.
Mae Nam. I have never eaten there. In fact, I'm not really aware of most of the like modern good restaurants in Vancouver.
Right, yeah. Road trip.
Yeah, I would like to go eat in Vancouver sometime.
The other really quick thing that just came up yesterday and I wanted to share with you. You know this this technique that we've talked about several times now for the rice cracker, the cook, roll, dehydrate, fry. And I came across it in the 11 Madison Park cookbook and was like, oh my goodness, what a novel modern technique. I was actually, because of Mainam, I was reading a little bit about Thai food. Sure enough, there's like a preparation called Khao Tang. That's exactly that. And it's like to make rice crackers that are served with like, well, all kinds of stuff, but eggplant salad and things like that. So it's, it just, I felt a little silly. Like I was like, oh wow, 11 Madison Park at the cutting edge of new culinary innovation. And then I was like, oh yeah, no, it's probably, it makes sense. It's like probably 1,000 years old kind of.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, that does make sense. And there are a lot of things like that. There are a lot of things that are like used in, you know, modern culinary technique that seem new because they are, I don't know, haven't been around for a while or in Western European cooking, they're sort of like forgotten about or ignored. But yeah, like I feel the same way about like, you know, a lot of starch preparations, like Asian starch preparation, like the tapioca shrimp cracker thing is like another example of that. Like that's not like a modern invention. That's, but it seems like if you, like the execution of it is used a lot in like sort of modernist type of restaurants on their menus and stuff like that, because it's sort of novel for us or for Europeans, but it's like, not that
actually,
novel.
You think about like a lot of, I mean, so much of the, what we might call inspiration for cutting, quote unquote, cutting edge stuff at high-end restaurants, like is really imported wholesale from, different regional cuisines. Like think about like the Noma, like the kind of garum type. Noma calls those calls them
that's
garum.
Hilarious. That's the exactly the that's exactly the example I was going to use.
Right, but I mean, like it's whatever. It's how is it? It's not really different than Southeast Asian fish sauce. Or and sorry, they're open about that. Like they know they're open about
totally.
It. Or Worcestershire or whatever. Anyways, yeah, it just made me. I'm trying to be like more intentionally learning about cuisines that I didn't grow up with and don't understand very well. And this was a reminder of why I do that. Why to do that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. That's good. So did you, you just happened to notice that you didn't find any, you didn't find any like bulletproof information for perfecting the technique in there while you were.
No, they were actually for this one. Like we talked about, one of the finicky parts of it is like how dry to make the rice. And their recommendation in this recipe was like it's in a 250 degree Fahrenheit oven for 4 to 5 hours. So that makes it sound like that's a much higher heat than I've been doing. In this recipe, it said that the rice will even like be lightly browned, like on the bottom of the rolled out sheet.
That's interesting.
So. I don't know if that makes it puff a little bit more reliably or consistently, but
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. Like we were saying a couple episodes ago, I think like the real way of doing it would be to like weigh everything and check the moisture content and weigh everything after you've dried it so that you understand how much moisture has been lost and then do that to like, you know, do that like 10 times so that you have like 10 different amounts of moisture and fry them all and
you know, sounds exhausting.
Yeah, it does sound exhausting. You'd probably get some like weird variable results too, and then you would be like, well, I don't just don't even know what to think here. Because the temperature of the oil could slightly fluctuate and there's a lot of variables. Yeah, so what are we going to talk about? Are we going to talk about Thanksgiving? Do you want to do that?
Sure.
Cool.
Yeah, so we're recording. We're between Thanksgiving and Halloween.
Yeah, and so should be released between Thanksgiving and Halloween, I would imagine.
That makes sense.
I look at my magic calendar. I believe it'll be released on the 19th. Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to talk about
Thanksgiving. So you had Thanksgiving dinner. I had Thanksgiving dinner. Maybe we can talk about what we cooked.
Sure.
And then try and talk about... I don't know. We had this dumb plan to talk about a Halloween menu, but I don't really have anything prepared for it. So I guess we'll see how that goes.
It's going to be the first tentative exploration of the development of a Halloween cuisine.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. a celebratory holiday cuisine centered around Halloween. Why don't we have that? I mean, aside from candy, obviously. Like, well, candy is Halloween cuisine, but...
I can answer why it doesn't exist, if you want.
Okay, sure.
Because...
Ghosts don't eat food, Alan.
You can't have an elaborate family meal the same night that the kids are going trick-or-treating. Plus, like, because the doorbell is going to ring every 2 minutes, you have to get up from the table. Do you know what I mean?
So, I guess I understand. Well, yeah, that definitely makes sense from a, like, from a logistical perspective for how Halloween currently exists in our culture, like its current incarnation. But I don't think trick-or-treating is like the only way that people celebrate Halloween.
That's true.
Yeah.
And actually, interestingly, okay, I know we're supposed to be talking about Thanksgiving, but...
Oh, man. we skipped right over Thanksgiving.
There's a book that I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, maybe in relation to our fruitcake discussions at Christmas.
Okay.
But it's called Of Turnips and Teas and Threshing Bees. And it's the memoir of a woman who was my grandmother's age and grew up in the town right beside the one where my grandmother grew up.
Okay.
And I read that she has a section on Halloween and what Halloween was like for her. This is like maybe in the 1920s, 30s and 40s kind of era. And she says specifically, like, none of us had even heard of trick-or-treating then. And so what, like, Halloween was usually like someone would, there'd be a dance basically. There's no candy, but there would be a dance held at someone's house. And in that context, you could see like a nice spread being put out, and like that, if you're celebrating Halloween in that style, it makes sense to have dedicated food for it besides candy.
There was a dance. Were there costumes?
She said some of them like would wear masks and stuff, but I don't think it was like a big dress up party the way that ours would be.
Right.
But really it was like, it was way more about pranks and mischief than ours is. Like, I know we say trick or treat and like we'll egg your house if you don't give us candy, but like it's not really serious pranks going on in my neighborhood anyways. But they would, like, from these memoirs, it was full on. It was like, she talked about like kids, like teenagers, I assume, disassembling somebody's wagon and then taking it onto the roof of their barn and reassembling it. Like that kind of thing. Or like stealing chickens and either like putting them in someone's outhouse so that when they go out in the middle of the night to use the toilet, that there's like chickens in the outhouse, or just like straight up stealing chickens and bringing them to a party to roast, like to, as like, say it's a gift, but like pretend that it's like a generous gift.
What a prank. I'm gonna take somebody's property.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the prank element, beside, like, yeah, you're right, it's just, it's petty crime, but the prank element is that they brought it to the house for the hostess to cook and like presented it as a gift. Like, we took, like, we killed some of our chicken so that we can,
right.
But then it was actually someone else's. And so she was mortified, to say the least.
Yeah. So I think that lends to my point that, like, I feel like at some point there probably could have or would have been Halloween fair, like,
yes,
and like probably similar to what Thanksgiving fair would be, like harvest time types of foods and stuff like that. But yeah.
Yes, there definitely was.
Yeah.
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 I read about, have you heard of coal cannon before? Maybe we served it at some of the burn suppers.
So yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's like basically like mashed potatoes or turnips with like some kind of like kale or cabbage mashed into it. That's associated with Halloween.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I wonder why. I mean, I guess that makes sense. Because it's harvest food.
Right. But,
yeah. Or harvest time food.
And then sometimes, okay, when you were little, did your mom ever like bake coins into a birthday cake or something like that?
No, I don't think we ever really did that. I was aware of it as a thing, but I don't think it's something that we ever did.
My mom did it sometimes. Like, she'd fold wax paper around coins and bake it into cakes for people. But that's another, like, sometimes in the coal cannon, like, they would put charms and it would be like a fortune telling kind of thing. Like, if you scoop out like I don't even know if there's a real example, like if there's like a thimble or something put into the coal can and you scoop that out, it means like you're going to be a spinster, or like you're not going to get married.
Ouch. Or
like stuff like that.
Yeah. That right there is a real prank.
I got
destroy
you.
Somebody's
you
life by giving them a
thimble. On a
thimble. Right. You put all thimbles in the cake.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, let's get back to Thanksgiving. So, what did you do to celebrate Thanksgiving this year?
On Sunday, I went to my mother-in-law's, and she made a substantial spread. She did like the turkey spread, but also the Ukrainian spread. So there was like turkey, mashed potatoes, stuffing, and also pierogies, lazy cabbage rolls, the whole kit and caboodle. And pies, way more pies.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it was tasty. And then on the Monday, I made a bunch of pies, and we put them in a wagon and took them to the park and invited a bunch of friends and had a little pie at the park party.
That's fun.
Yeah, it was good.
Were the pies warm when you ate them at the park? I guess not, hey?
The apple pies were right out of the oven.
Oh, nice.
But I had to six pies. So I had to batch them. So the first batch was cooled by the time we got to the park.
We had a dinner with most of my like immediate family at my brother and sister-in-law's place. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was pretty standard, I would say. We had turkey, mashed potatoes, gravy, stuffing, yams, which is usually a part of that type of dinner. I kind of feel like maybe it's a little more associated with Christmas dinner than it is with...
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
I don't know. Is that weird? I don't know. Anyway, and we had a salad, which my sister-in-law made, and then I think she also brought bread. My mom roasted some beets. My brother's mother-in-law... my sister-in-law's mom. I don't know what is that also my mother-in-law? I don't know.
No, it's not.
No, I guess not. Eh? she brought nechenka, which is like
the cornmeal.
Ukrainian cornmeal dish. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's usually present at our like family meals.
Cool.
Sometimes there are cabbage rolls, but there weren't cabbage rolls this time. So I guess it was simplified somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of the food cooking for it. I made the turkey. I made the mashed potatoes. I made the gravy. I made the yams. I sort of dressed up the beets that my mom roasted.
Mm-hmm.
Is that pretty much it? Yeah, I think that's everything that I did. My dad picked up the turkey, and then my sister brought it home, and then I brined it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have a place to store a turkey at my house. I think the last time I made a turkey was probably Christmas last year.
Mm-hmm.
And the temperature was perfect that I could like store it in my garage in a container.
Right,
like it was like cold enough outside that the inside of the garage was like fridge temperature.
Right. Yeah.
So I was able to brine it in the garage in a container. But yeah, there's not really room in my fridge to brine a turkey. So I either have to do it at work or in my garage if it's cold enough. And it was definitely not cold enough this time around. So I had to brine it at work in the walk-in fridge there.
Right. Yeah. It's hard. We had a turkey as well. And like just to get it in the fridge, it's like, okay, all the pickles and mustard and everything is coming out of the fridge so that the turkey can be in there for a couple of days. And
Yeah. There is probably a way for me to rearrange my fridge to fit a turkey in there, but man, yeah, it would have been pretty crazy. Mm-hmm. Like I would have had, and it was a pretty big bird, so I would have had to pull a lot of stuff out. I have a few meal kits in there. I don't know what I would have done with those. I would have had to like freeze them or something. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But yeah, luckily I have access to a walk-in fridge at work. And so I was just able to take the turkey to work and throw it in a big Cambro and,
mm-hmm.
cover it with brine and throw it in the fridge there. And then also because I usually wind up working on the weekend, so I usually wind up working on the day that we're going to have our dinner.
Right. Yeah.
Sometimes it works out that I'm like, often on Christmas, I'm not working. So I kind of have the whole day to just work on making the meal. And so for Christmas dinner, I'll do some prep ahead of time. But my plan is usually just like to start early and take it slow on the day, you know, and just sort of like prepare everything like one thing at a time and figure out a way to keep it warm or re-therm it when I need to. But a lot of the time, and especially like for Thanksgiving, I'm usually working on the day. So I have to figure out a way to basically do it like a catering event. So everything is like totally ready ahead of time. And then I have a plan to re-therm it before we eat. And so, yeah, what I did this year to figure that out was I made the mashed potatoes a couple of days ahead. I made the stuffing a couple of days ahead. I made the yams a few days ahead, and I just put them all in like containers that I was going to use to reheat them in. Mm-hmm. So the mashed potatoes I put in like Ziploc bags, just to like reheat them in a pot of hot water or in sous vide or something like that. And then same with the stuffing, but that's a little trickier because stuffing has a lot of air in it. And so it doesn't want to, it's hard to like retherm it in a bag. It's better to do it in the oven, but
okay. Yeah.
I wasn't sure if I was going to have enough oven space. So I just like put that all in bags too. And then I had the yams in like a foil container, and then I cooked the whole turkey sous vide. Like I broke it down and cooked the whole turkey sous vide and roasted the carcass ahead of time. And then basically as soon as when I got to my brother and sister-in-law's place, I plugged in my circulator and put all of the turkey in there to reheat. The legs I had cooked overnight, like the night before to the day of Thanksgiving. And then the breasts I cooked on the day, and then I brought everything there, plugged in my sous vide bath, heated up the turkey in the sous vide bath, and then put the mashed potatoes and the stuffing in a, well, actually I wound up taking the mashed potatoes out of the bag and just heating them up in a pan, which was faster and worked just fine. I was worried that maybe some of the, I put a lot of butter in those mashed potatoes. I was worried that maybe some of it was going to come out, but it was fine. And yeah, I just reheated everything basically. And I made the gravy once I got there. I had the turkey stock from the bags. I didn't have turkey stock from the carcass that I had roasted yet because I just didn't have time to get that ready. So I brought some like just chicken broth in Tetra containers. And then I took all of the liquid out of the sous vide bags that I had cooked the turkey in and used that. And yeah, just made a gravy once I got there.
You know what my one, the... Okay, sous videing the turkey. Great.
Yeah.
What about the skin?
Yeah. So what I usually do is I rewarm the turkey in the bags and then take it out of the bags and put it in a roasting pan and broil it to crisp the skin up. It's not as good, definitely. It's not as good as like the skin that you get if you roast the whole turkey in the oven. But, you know, it gets crispy enough that it's not like weird or something. And yeah, the other thing that you could do is just remove all the skin, but that would be sad. So I just broil it, and it comes out okay. It's not, if I feel like there are way better ways of doing it, like I don't know, I mean just roasting it is perfectly acceptable, and I would have done that, and I've done it several times. Like you brine it and then you roast it carefully so that you don't overcook the breasts and you get the legs nice and juicy. Like that's a great way to cook a bird. I don't necessarily think that sous vide is a superior way to cook it. It just like, it was a more convenient way for me to do this year because I was going to have to reheat it. But yeah, what I do is I just broil the skin under the broiler after I take it out of the sous vide bags, and it works okay.
That's my, like we've talked about before, I think, but like, yeah, I usually will break down the bird and brine it, whatever. My one quibble with that, even though it lets you control the finishing temperature really well, because you've, like the turkey skin generally like needs a lot of
rendering.
Yeah, exactly. So like even when I do say the breast, like pan sear the breast and finish it in the oven or whatever, even though you can get good color on the skin, by the time the breast is at the right temperature, the skin is not rendered and crispy. It like looks nice. It's amber because you seared it or whatever, but like it's not crisp. And so that's my one part of it that I haven't really figured out yet, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think broiling can help with that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree. It's tough. And then like the other thing about roasting it in the oven is it gets very evenly rendered and very evenly browned, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Whereas like doing it under the broiler, you kind of get this direct heat. So part of it gets rendered and crispy, but, mm-hmm. you know, like then there's a part that's like sort of lower down the side that doesn't quite get as crispy. And you know,
I wonder if one solution would be to treat like a boneless or like a supreme turkey breast that's been brined, treat it like a duck breast and like score the skin and then like slow render in the pan. I don't know. Maybe that would work.
Yeah, maybe. I think like the benefit of the duck breast is that it's so flat. Like, I think you would have trouble with a turkey breast getting all of the skin in contact with the pan because the skin really like wraps around, like is really curved around the breast and the shape of the breast is very round. Mm-hmm. And so I think you'd have trouble getting even contact to render in the pan like that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if you were just standing there moving it around and like holding it to,
right.
you know, then you could do it. But it sounds, yeah. it sounds like a lot of work
and maybe basting
finicky or something. But yeah, the broiler is my sort of easy solution for that mm-hmm. problem.
Mm-hmm. I actually have turkey bones in my oven right now that I have to go take out.
Seriously?
Yes. Okay. I'll be 20 seconds.
Okay. Man, your house must smell delicious.
It does.
Yeah.
Okay, that was Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah. So what were the things that you cooked for yours?
So we had the pie.
You say you didn't have to cook anything. I am going to be so jealous.
Okay. So we had the full spread at my mother-in-law's on Sunday, cooked a whole bunch of pies on Monday. And then mm-hmm. we did have a turkey actually that my mother-in-law raised. But we were pretty casual about it. So like on Monday I broke it down and I braised one of the legs for supper on Monday evening. And then the next day I like made soup and cooked more of the meat to put in the soup. And I actually just cooked the last of it today. So it was more like we brought in a turkey and we made a bunch of soup.
Made a bunch of dinners out of it
turkey rather strips
than just like eating a whole roasted turkey yeah. for Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because we had the full meal on Sunday and then most of Monday I was working on the pies. So we ate turkey. But it was not the whole smorg kind of.
So you made a bunch of turkey stuff, but you didn't specifically roast a turkey for your dinner. But you did make a bunch of pies.
Yes, that's right.
Which pies did you make?
I made Saskatoon and rhubarb with oatmeal streusel topping. And a couple pumpkin pies, a couple apple pies, and a sour cherry pie.
Sweet. We had pumpkin pie. Like store-bought pumpkin pie for our dinner. Mm-hmm. And it was good. I totally understand what store-bought pumpkin pie is going to be like, mm-hmm. but I don't know. Like I used to be super into that. Like I used to be like really into store-bought pumpkin pie, mm-hmm. like also like homemade pumpkin pie, but store-bought pumpkin pie, it was something that I was like excited about, you right. know, like, but I think I'm not excited about store-bought pumpkin pie anymore. And I don't think it's necessarily because they've gotten any worse. I think I just, right. yeah, I think I don't like it as much as I used to or something.
What are your qualms? Is it bland or what?
It's a little bit bland and mostly just the crust isn't very well developed. It's like, right. yeah. you know, it's the crust is like not flaky. It's just sort of like just cooked and right. kind of doughy
yeah.
and stuff. And
yeah.
yeah. That just, yeah, I don't know. It feels like a missed opportunity because the crust could be like really good, you know. And I don't know, maybe the crust did used to be better when I was younger or something. Maybe they used to take more care when they were baking them or something. But yeah, I don't know.
I mean, they sit on a shelf at room temperature for days on end. Like, I don't know if you can have a really great crust in that context, but.
Yeah, agreed.
But you're right. It's definitely not flaky. It's more of a conventional short dough kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about your pumpkin pies? Flaky?
Yes.
Yeah.
We do. Yes. Flaky. Like it's the standard, like 3-2-1 North American pie dough, flour, right. butter, water. And I can't remember if we've talked about this, but like the what's different about mine is the filling. So I use we'll roast kabocha squash and then puree it with cream, eggs, sugar, and ginger. Mm-hmm. And so the pie ends up with like a really, it's the color of a pumpkin. Like it's a bright orange. Like it's really, it's not the like brown of a store-bought pumpkin pie or the pumpkin pie filling from cans. It's like seriously like a sunny pumpkin orange color. And I like the kind of generic like cinnamon and pumpkin pie spice mix, but I also like just focusing on one. I usually will do like ground ginger. But like it would be fun. I think there's loads of, maybe not if you're cooking for kids, but like to do like cardamom or something like that would be cool. Yeah. Just like one spice that works really well with the pumpkin. But.
Cool. You ever put MSG in your pumpkin pie?
No, I put salt in, but
I feel like, I don't know. I feel like that would be good.
Huh?
I don't know. Curious to try it.
What made you think of that?
I have no idea. I don't know what's going on in my brain.
Huh? Okay.
Yeah, I do think like pumpkin has like a very, and squash, well, they're the same thing, I guess. I don't know.
Wow.
There's a lot of weird definitions for what pumpkin, there's a lot of people calling things that I don't consider pumpkins and a lot of, yeah. But,
oh, really?
Yeah. In Europe, every kind of squash is called a pumpkin by English speaking people. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, they also will call them squashes, and I think sometimes they'll call them by like the name that, but yeah, like that group of vegetables in general is called pumpkins.
Like in the UK?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's odd.
I think it's odd too. It was very confusing for me at first, but yeah, but that's a thing. Like kabocha squash, they would call that a pumpkin. It's a kind of pumpkin.
I do not approve.
Me too also. But yeah, I just think of like squash as having a lot of umami flavor that mm-hmm. you can develop by like roasting it or baking it or something like that. And I think that's part of what's attractive about a pumpkin pie is that like it is sweet and like and has this like spiced aroma and stuff. But it also has like sort of this richness and umami that makes it very satisfying. And I wonder if you heightened that by adding a little bit of MSG, if that would be if that would make it
good or terrible.
Yeah, good or terrible, exactly.
Like, sorry, was it MSG that you tried to put in your coffee, or was that just salt?
Yeah, that did not work very well. Okay.
Sorry to bring that up. That was, but...
No, it's okay. It was worth trying, but that was not good. It was really bad. You can put a few grains of salt in your coffee as long as you can't taste the saltiness. Like it helps it taste a little softer or something, like tones down the bitterness a little bit, but MSG, not good.
Yeah. Okay, I have an idea. What about pumpkin pie with the spice element being like something like curry or vadouvant? What do you think of that?
I don't see why not.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it might be, and especially for like a Western palate, it might be a little bit confusing. I don't know. Like if you made, so for instance, like if you made a pumpkin pie that was like a savory course and you just made like a curried pumpkin pie, like the same way that you might make like, well, I guess a sweet potato pie is also a dessert. But like, yeah, if it was like meant as a savory dish, I think for sure that would work. Mm-hmm. Like you could definitely get away with it. For dessert, I think it might be a little like
challenging,
confusing or something. Yeah.
I think about it because I've seen curry sneak in. Curry or like, sorry, do you know vadouvant? I never even heard of it until
I am aware of it, but I don't exactly remember what the flavor profile of it is.
Like, I think it's basically the French version of like English curry powder.
Oh, okay. Fair.
So like that to say like a European adaptation or whatever of foreign spice mixtures.
Right.
But I've seen it creep into some sweet applications.
Okay.
Yeah. And Mignardise and desserts and stuff. But I wonder if like, it's interesting as a one bite kind of petit four or something, but like, yeah, like a whole slice of pumpkin pie that has the curry flavor, might be a bit much. I don't know. Just popped into my head.
I mean, a lot of the flavors that are in curry are very much also, you know, like cardamom and
used in Western baking and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Are like part of the sort of like fall spice flavor profiles or whatever. But then there are a bunch of other things in curry that aren't necessarily associated with that. And also like, well, I don't think that there's like garlic in curry powder, like in masala curry or whatever, but you know, like you tend to wind up associating like those savory, like garlic and onion with those curry flavors, with the turmeric and stuff like that. So I don't know. It's without the garlic and stuff, what, you know, what would it, is it like, would it be totally delicious to just sweeten it and have it as a dessert type of thing? I don't know. I've never really tried that. It's worth a shot, Alan. Should we bake pie right now?
I still have dough in my fridge.
So. Yeah, live on the podcast. Just tape. Do you have any tape in that room? Just tape your microphone to your head and just walk. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, definitely worth a try, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's probably delicious.
And you can use coconut milk instead of cream.
Oh, damn. Yeah, this is starting to sound better and better all the time. I don't know why that wouldn't be delicious. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've definitely made like butternut squash soup that has like curry flavor profiles that's like sweet enough that I'm like, man, this is practically dessert. And man, the yams that I made for Thanksgiving dinner, those were crazy.
How so?
They were very sweet, but they were delicious. I think they're the best yams I've ever made.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I took like, what did I do? I roasted them with the skins on and then I peeled them. And then I just like cut them into chunks, I guess. Like I didn't mash them or anything. I just like cut them into sort of like rough chunks. But they were quite soft. So part of them kind of got mashed during that process. Mm-hmm. And then I put like, what? I started with probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 pounds of yams or something like that. And then probably 3 pounds. And then by the time I roasted them and took the skins off, I probably had like 2.5 pounds or something like that. And I took like 1/2 pound of butter and browned it on the stove, just like cooked it until it was lightly browned, I guess. Like a light beurre noisette. And then I just took like probably almost 1/2 cup of maple syrup and I just poured it into the brown butter while it was hot.
Oh, really?
And then it like boiled up and kind of turned into a caramel. Like at first it like the butter boiled away the syrup very vigorously because it was very hot, but I kind of like poured in all the syrup at once and that cooled down the butter. But then I brought it back to a simmer and I just boiled it and it turned into like basically an emulsified caramel.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I just poured that whole thing into the yams. Like I added a bit of salt to it and then I just poured that whole thing into the yams and just mixed it together. And then I toasted some cashews and just had them to put on it as a garnish when I finished it. But man, it was so tasty.
Yeah, sounds good.
It was delicious. It was very sweet, but it was really good. I'd never really done that before. I've used those flavors before, but I'd never like done the thing where I brown the butter and then pour the syrup in and turn it into like a caramel. Right. That was crazy.
Yeah.
And it sort of happened by accident.
Okay. Yeah.
And it was delicious.
Yeah. That sounds like a good, like even just having like a caramel, like an actual caramel, like a square of caramel candy with those flavors sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That it works really well in my brain to put caramel with yams. Like, and that was kind of what I was going for when I was roasting them too, was like to get a little bit of, you know, color and caramelization development on the outside of them or whatever, so that they would make a little bit of their own caramel. But then, yeah, I guess I just boosted that using like this maple caramel that I made.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really good. Everything else I did pretty much how I normally do it, without too much sort of like variation. Everything else was pretty standard, but the yams was sort of a bit of an invention.
Cool.
Or at least that one part of it. Garlic mashed potatoes. That was easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Garlic smashed potatoes, more like, pretty much. I didn't like rice them or anything. I just beat them up in the stand mixer.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything was good. and family was good. It was nice to hang out with family.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah. I'm tired now, though.
Now?
Yeah. All week. I've been like really tired. I don't know why. I had a couple days where I didn't go to bed quite on time. Oh, what are we talking about?
Oh, wait, man. Are we recording right now?
I'm gonna have
right
to leave that in too. Anyways, are we done talking about Thanksgiving dinner? Yours was good. Mine was good. We made some food. You made some pies.
Yeah.
Everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And was there anything like, I don't know. This usually happens to me when I'm making Thanksgiving dinner. I start to sort of like think about what I might do for Christmas dinner. Does that happen to you at all?
Oh, yeah. I could see why that would happen. No, it didn't cross my mind at all this weekend.
Yeah. I guess I have sort of a bit of a plan brewing, and it's like a pretty standard plan, but you know, just sort of like, oh, here's, you know, these are the techniques that I would reuse when we go to make Christmas dinner this year. And,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, and thinking about the bird and the treatment of the bird and okay, you know, on Christmas, can I actually roast the bird whole instead of like
right.
breaking it down and sous vide-ing it? Or is it worth doing that? Or, you know, is it better to do that, break down the bird ahead of time so that I can have the carcass and make the stock and then make gravy mm-hmm. out of that and stuff like that? I just started to think about it.
I think it would be funny, like, if it all comes full circle and you decide that the best way to prepare the bird is to just, like, season it and roast it whole. It's like, I don't know, just the trends, like, we're so adamant, like, it's Alton Brown's fault, I think, but like, you know, you break down the bird, then you get stock, you can brine it, you can control finishing temperatures, but then yeah, like yeah. as we do it again and again, it's like, oh well, what if we didn't break down the bird?
What if I just roasted the bird whole? That would like, A, be easier, what and B, it's still did. Delicious. Like, yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's there.
Yeah.
There's a good...
Oh, I know one thing I was going to ask you. Mm-hmm. Like, well... And this is somewhat related. Like when I do roast a bird whole, I never stuff it,
mm-hmm.
which is like something that was like sort of traditional. Like you would make stuffing inside the bird.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the name stuffing.
Right.
Normally when I roast a bird now, I just like stuff it with something else flavorful that's going to add some flavor to it. And then I make stuffing outside the bird.
Mm-hmm.
But so... I think, oh yeah. Oh, so at Thanksgiving dinner, I was calling the stuffing stuffing, and my brother was like, well, it's not stuffing if it's not cooked in the bird. And I was like, yeah, that's true. But also I think it's more of like just the colloquial usage of the word,
mm-hmm.
like means that like it no longer matters really whether you put it in the bird or not, whether you call it stuffing or not.
Yeah.
I know some people call it dressing, but I thought that that was more of like a regional thing.
Mm, I see. Yeah. I, even though I like come off as like really pedantic and and pretentious and stuff, I generally
you don't come off as pedantic and pretentious.
Okay. But I do generally stand up for colloquial uses when describing food, even if they don't,
yeah,
even if they aren't strictly accurate, because that's the culture. So like even something like right, say like yeah. calling bison buffalo, you're not supposed to call it buffalo because it's not really buffalo, it's bison, it's a different thing. But like if you want to call it like it, there's a history of calling that animal buffalo in North America,
right? And if people understand what that means when you say it, then using it is effective.
Yes,
because yeah,
yeah, because it has a certain different connotation. Like it's
yeah,
you can say something different by using that word. So yeah,
well, to like, be fair, that was like kind of my sister-in-law's argument around the word earthy, is that like you right, kind yeah. of understand. Oh,
yeah,
totally,
yeah.
Right,
yeah,
you know, and like I do have sympathy for that argument, but I do think that like if you're trying to convey what something tastes like to someone,
mm-hmm.
that earthy is not specific enough. But yeah, I definitely think that there is a colloquial meaning around the word earthy, mm-hmm. that like people sort of have like a vague understanding of what it means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think it's accurate, but it, you know, it's legit.
Mm-hmm.
There's like, you know, there's definitely a connotative meaning there,
mm-hmm.
that people understand. So
I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but I'm sure there's like dozens and dozens of preparations, like like food preparations that they have a name that doesn't make sense anymore, but the origin of the name is like, well, they used to make it this way. And
right.
Yeah. Can you think of one? I'm going to put you on the spot.
I mean, most of them are in different languages. I'm sure there's tons in French. Let me think. Oh, well, calling a roast,
right? Yeah.
Is sort of along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, like probably most roasts are still roasted though. So it's like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you might just call, like, sometimes even the raw meat, like if it's not cut into steaks or chops,
if
it's a roast.
If it's like, totally. If it, and if it's tied up in sort of like a round kind of lump that you're going to put in the oven, then it's a roast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's tons of them. Most food names or like most food preparations probably have some kind of history like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just become, the meaning changes over time and just becomes the word for the thing that you're eating.
Yeah, not, exactly.
Not the technique that you're using to prepare it or whatever.
Even stuff like, I don't know if this is exactly the same thing, but things like pesto, where it's like, originally it's like, it's got to be, it's basil and parm and pine nuts and olive oil and lemon or whatever. But now like to us, like maybe it still means that to someone who lives in Genoa, but like to us now it's like, it's a herb puree.
Herb puree with probably nuts.
Nuts
and
are
cheese,
nice. Cheese is nice. Yeah. But like, am I going to like insist that it's not a pesto because it doesn't have nuts in it? I don't know.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah, exactly.
But we're, all, I think, a little bit more cavalier with our language, like in North America than in other parts of the world. But
yeah. Well, and, you know, like pesto isn't an English word. It's an Italian word, right? So it probably like has different, you know, a different etymology and a different meaning structure in Italian that might make that seem really weird to call something else pesto that isn't or something. But so Halloween,
so enough of the past. Thanksgiving, we're gonna look to the future.
Look to the future
to Halloween. And so what are some of the ingredients or components or preparations or ideas that you need to include in a proposed Halloween cuisine? Halloween.
Yeah, this is
cuisine.
Tough. Like, okay, if we're saying, I know we're not actually saying we're looking to the future. I realize that that's a joke about the fact that Halloween is like in the next couple of weeks or whatever. But if we're not gonna look to the past to try and determine what types of foods might have historically been, you know, Halloween type of foods.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think if we're trying to define what foods you might serve at like a Halloween dinner or celebration or something like that, then you kind of have to use like modern Halloween pop culture to sort of
So it's a Tim Burton.
Your ideas.
It's a Tim Burton menu, you mean?
Here we are again. Yeah.
Oh, great.
I mean, maybe not strictly Tim Burton, but I think that like if you want something that's going to be like actually Halloween themed, you have to sort of like look at what Halloween is to people now, and and then like use that to inspire what your dish ideas might be. And I think that, you know, like what is Halloween now? It's like,
that's a great question.
It's costuming, right?
Yeah.
Like that's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. It's probably mischief is a bit like a bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, I think that this maybe toned down a little bit compared to what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an excuse for people to get drunk. So definitely probably liquor is going to feature heavily in the menu. And then maybe it's like, you know, it's a lot of monsters and supernatural creatures and cryptids and things like that.
What's a cryptid?
Isn't a cryptid like a cryptozoological creature? You don't know what cryptozoology is, Alan?
Does crypto means secret, right? Cryptozoology.
Yeah, so
cryptozoology
is like Bigfoots and Loch Ness monsters all these creatures that know may or may not be real or whatever.
Okay.
Which I don't personally believe in.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I know there's a lot of video footage out there that people consider to be hard evidence.
Right.
So I guess,
That's so funny. I would, I like Sasquatch and Loch Ness Monster. To me, that's something entirely different than the creatures that we associate with Halloween, because those ones are more rooted in like mythology and
right.
Yeah. Whereas,
but I think like I doubt that. I'm pretty sure that somebody dresses up as Sasquatch for Halloween. Like
that's true, but they also dress up as a Lego person. I don't know.
That's true.
I don't know why that was the first Halloween costume that came to my mind.
That's good. So it's going to be a Lego themed dinner then.
So, okay. I agree with all of your, like, yeah, that those are the important elements of contemporary Halloween. So how do you make that into food?
To a meal? Yeah, that is such a great question, Alan. And this is why this conversation is going to go downhill quickly, because I actually haven't prepared anything and have no idea how to derive inspiration from those things to make like a cohesive dinner plan.
Okay. Well, here's some...
Do you have an idea?
I thought about this a bit, but I'm going in 10 different directions. I have like... Part of me was thinking about like, yeah, so if we're, are we picturing this as like something like Thanksgiving where it's like a home, like a home cooked meal tradition? Or is
it? I think so. Like, that's sort of what I'm thinking in the back of my head. I'm sort of like, I mean, I know this makes me lame, but like going, dressing up and going out to Halloween parties isn't really my thing anymore.
Okay.
And I understand that that's really what Halloween is, or trick or treating for parents. Mm-hmm. And children. Mm-hmm. But those, you know, like those are the things that are like central to like what Halloween sort of really is now. But for me, I really enjoy like all of the like pop culture aspects of Halloween. I enjoy like, you know, thinking about the horror movie aspects of it and monsters and,
yep.
You know, thinking about ghosts, even though I don't believe in that stuff. It's just fun to like, think about those things and think about creepy things and maybe get a little bit scared and, you know, maybe want to leave the lights on or something like that. Right. Like,
yeah.
I enjoy that. I enjoy the vibe of Halloween, but the actual celebration of it to me just hasn't really been my thing for a while. Mm-hmm. And I know that that makes me lame. I would still love to dress up if I really had like a purpose to,
right.
But it is quite a bit of work, and I don't really like going to house parties and drinking and stuff like that. And I think that's what a lot of sort of like young adults do, is like get dressed up and go
right.
Hang out at someone's house and have a house party and drink. And that's just, I don't know, mm-hmm. I'm not really into it. Mm-hmm. But like for me, what I would love is if there was some kind of like, you know, like alternative Halloween kind of celebration thing where you did like where it was like, you know, sort of a dinner tradition like we mm-hmm. do on Thanksgiving or something like that. And I think that there's room for there to be like a different kind of more fun sort of like dinner kind of tradition for Halloween
mm-hmm.
That isn't just like, you know, a regular holiday dinner, but is a little bit more creative and maybe centered in kind of those like horror aspects of it or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it would be great if we could come up with something like that. And then I would think that it would be even better if it gained traction and people started having Halloween dinner parties with Halloween themed foods and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Anyways, you've given it some thought, which I have not. So
I'm just going to start throwing out ideas.
Okay.
And some of them are more like tasting menu kind of stuff and not like home cooked food. But
okay.
So like to me, the most obvious way to nod to the traditions of trick or treat and stuff is like you can picture petit fours or mignardises that are like inspired by the junky candies that we like to eat. So like for instance, God.
Yeah, this was like what you're talking about right now is like the only idea that popped into my head
right.
In like the last 5 days.
It's the yeah, this
like
is
making
the...
making a cake that looks like a candy corn is like the only thing that I could think of.
But this,
I was so mad at myself because you know how much I hate candy corn.
Yeah.
And I was just like, why is this the only thing that I can think of?
This is the most obvious idea. Like it's the low hanging fruit of this discussion,
yeah,
but like
for sure
we've, for instance, I make Pat de Fruy, like the fruit gummies from our sour cherries. And sometime I think at Elm we did this for an event, but we discovered that instead of just crusting them with the traditional granulated white sugar, if you do half sugar and half powdered citric acid, it tastes just like a Sour Patch Kid.
Right.
So you can do this like homemade, excellent sour version patch of a Sour Patch Kid. You could make a salted caramel like Erica's Red Balloon caramels and then wrap it in plastic. And it's a nod to the caramel squares. I think we've talked about like maybe candying crab apples, having like little like candied crab apple on a stick. Have we talked about that?
Yeah. Like having like a little caramel apple, little candy apple, but it's made out of a crab apple.
Yeah.
If you can find crab apple that isn't mealy, that would be great.
Yeah. And then the other obvious one I think would be pumpkin pie.
Right.
But then we're kind of infringing on Thanksgiving, but is there something?
I mean, honestly, I kind of feel like Halloween should own the pumpkin pie and Thanksgiving should give it up, you know?
Thanksgiving
like,
should be apple and Halloween can be pumpkin.
Yeah, exactly. That makes more sense to me.
Call it jack-o'-lantern pie.
Yeah, and decorate it like a jack-o'-lantern.
What if you, what about, you know how we talk about torching the pumpkin pie?
Yeah.
Is there a way? Okay, here's a business idea.
okay, great.
You know the traditional way to make creme brulee where you heat an iron? Like before they had propane blowtorches in kitchens, they would heat an iron and then hold it right up like close to the surface to start melting sugar and then maybe gently touch it to the surface. Have you seen that? Like,
right. Yeah, I have. Yeah.
So can you make...
And you can create a design that way?
Yeah. What if you make a pumpkin pie and then you brand it as so it looks like a jack-o'-lantern's face?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Or if you only put sugar, the other way to do that would be to like take sort of like a
stencil
template.
Yeah.
Yeah, a stencil and just like, shake sugar through the parts of the stencil that are like a jack-o'-lantern and just brulee those parts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it could be the, like everybody knows pumpkin pie, but maybe there's some way to turn pumpkin pie. Like there's a Halloween pumpkin pie. By some nuance of the presentation or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it would have to start out that way because Thanksgiving is not actually going to give up pumpkin pie.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to sort of like sneak Halloween pumpkin pie in the back door by having it be an alternate presentation. Mm-hmm. But then hopefully over time, people will come to associate pumpkin pie more with Halloween than they do with Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And then Thanksgiving will be forced to give it up as a staple.
One other thing, like food-wise, that I associate with Halloween is toasted pumpkin seeds.
Oh, yeah.
Because my mom would, like, bake the seeds.
Take the seeds out of the pumpkin that you're going to turn into a jack-o'-lantern and reuse those as, like, a salty snack.
Yeah. And that's, honestly, like, the seeds in jack-o'-lantern pumpkins, like, aren't actually very, they're like, I eat them. I still bake the seeds from our pumpkins.
Do you?
But, like, it's, like, they're pretty fibrous or like they're pretty hard when they come out and it's like it's almost like chewing gum in that like it's like a kind of intense like tactile kind of feeling in your mouth, but it's not like the most pleasurable. I don't know if there's some way to revisit it.
Well, I mean, like the real way to do that is to like, because they have like a fibrous coating on them, but then the actual seed is like the seed part that you would like consider like a pumpkin seed, like a pepita or something like that, is actually like the inside of the pumpkin seed.
Like the hull is taken off, right? Yeah.
And the hull is the fibrous part, but it's a lot of work to do that by hand.
Right. So
I agree that like the pumpkins that we use for jack-o'-lanterns, like they don't have much of a seed inside, like the hull. It's
very flat.
It's a lot of hull and a very small amount of seed. Yeah. So
it's hard,
kind of not really worth it.
It's hard to imagine someone hauling pumpkin seeds from a jack-o'-lantern at home. But obviously, you can also just go out and buy hauled pumpkin seeds. But but that could be a little bar snack at the beginning of the meal.
That's the first savory idea, so that's good.
Okay, I have this idea for a soup, but like I think it needs something to make it more... it's kind of like a fall idea more than like a Halloween idea.
Okay.
Although I do. Okay. So the idea is this, it's a, like a cream of mushroom soup in a bowl and it is garnished with, crispy shaved carrots and parsnips and other root vegetables like that. So much so okay. that you can't even see the soup underneath.
Oh.
And it's called autumn leaves.
That's a cool
so
idea.
It's like eating, it looks like dried, like fallen autumn leaves. But then there's like a creamy soup underneath. Or you could call it dead leaves on the dirty ground.
That gives it a bit of, the word dead gives it a bit more of a Halloween vibe or something. Yeah, I think it's a great idea. See, like the problem with coming up with a Halloween menu is that my brain goes to novelty stuff all the time. Because I think that like, you know, our like associations with Halloween are all these like novelty monster kind of things and stuff like that. And so those are like the only things that I can think of that really say Halloween in the way that, you know, that most people would identify with it or something. Mm-hmm. But I think that's like a really cool idea. I haven't really seen it done before. And, you know, if you could somehow make that associated with Halloween, I think like part of that that seems Halloween-y to me is the surprise.
Yeah. There like, needs to be some kind of, that's right. Like a surprise or prank element to something in the
because the danger is that like, you know, because Halloween is so strongly associated with candy, like all of the ideas that we've come up with so far mostly are sweet ideas except for that one that you just espoused, which, you know, I think is a great idea. But yeah, I think to approach like the more savory foods, it would have to be kind of, maybe like it looks like something, but it's actually something else. Like it, you know, like, I don't know, like it looks like an egg, but it's actually like a savory cheese inside or something, or it's you know, and like most of the, and then again, like most of the foods that are usually like that are kind of generally like that tend to be more pastry based as well, like tend to be more desserts, unless you're talking about actual like, you know, modernist meals or something like that, in which case those types of things do sort of sneak themselves into the like savory courses, but you know, a lot of that type of like disguising something as something else comes from desserts and pastries.
Right. So. And I associate it much more with restaurants than with home cooking.
But. Home cooking. Yeah, for sure.
What about?
Yeah. And usually very difficult to pull off at home. So
you just mentioned the egg. No, sorry, the cheese that looks like an egg. But like, what about the whole repertoire of food that has devil in the name, like whether
that's a great
deviled
idea.
Eggs, but also like, isn't there like, there's an Italian, well, kind of like shakshuka we were talking about in the last couple of conversations, but like in Italy I think there's a dish called eggs in hell or something, and it's like eggs cracked into spicy tomato sauce.
Oh man.
But yeah, sorry, that's just shakshuka, but
but that sounds perfect. Sounds like the perfect type of thing. Also deviled ham, that's a thing.
Is that just ham with cayenne?
No, it's ham with like other spices in it. It's like, it's kind of like a, it's sort of like spam or something. Like,
oh, really?
It's like pieces of pork that are like that were pre-cooked and then reconstructed in some way and with like spices in it and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
A lot of the other ideas I had were the opposite of what you're saying, where I was like looking back. Cause I mentioned I was reading that memoir from my grandmother's era. And so a lot of mine were more backwards looking, like if we're having dinner, we're not trick or treating, we're not watching a horror movie. So like, why don't we hearken back to that other tradition? And so like, I know like turnips actually. So like the original jack-o'-lanterns apparently were turnips. Like in Ireland, they would carve turnips or potatoes and put candles in them.
Right.
So turnips are really associated with Halloween. I don't know what you would make, but yeah, the turnips and the coal cannon were
like a big deal.
My mind was going, but
yeah.
But yeah, you're obviously.
Yeah, and
mean
I think
anything.
That those things are great. We just have to figure out a way to like sort of use the novelty aspect of like modern Halloween to somehow associate them with Halloween dinner or something.
So
like
you
that.
You carve a turnip into a jack-o'-lantern and then you roast it and serve it.
Yeah, and it looks like a little shrunken head.
Yeah,
or something
and you
like
there's something maybe you can like pour into it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, turnip heads. That's a good one. Okay, we did one.
Well, I don't know, like a stuffed turnip, like a turnip stuffed with braised pork and wild rice or something. I don't know, like
or something with deviled ham.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Yeah, a stuffed turnip carved. I think carved vegetables is a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like your surprise soup idea.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then I guess as a main course, like if you wanted to have like a meat course or something like that, mm-hmm. it would be pretty easy to like dress up a roast, like a head or
yeah.
something.
Yeah, it'd be easy, super easy.
Some dumb novelty idea. You can put spaghetti hair on it. It would look just like Large Marge.
Yeah, I knew she was going to come up. Is there some, this is getting weird and gross, but like there's the whole like where you make like kind of tactile stations for children where it's like they're putting their hands in cold spaghetti.
This is definitely something that went through my head. Like, is your dinner like a haunted house? Like,
and you, like blindfolds are involved and they're like feeling peeled yeah. grapes and you're telling them it's eyeballs and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I was also thinking actually that because, you know, like, I don't know, like 10 years ago or something, there was like this like, you know, real like sort of weird modernist restaurant revolution where like experience giving people experiences like it was part of the thing yeah. So there was like restaurants where you wear headphones or
yes.
restaurants where you have to wear a blindfold or a restaurant that's like completely in the dark yes. and stuff like that.
Lisa ate it,
you know, those were the kinds of things that were popping into my head when I was like, oh, what's a Halloween dinner? Is it like experiential? Do you have to like eat in the dark and not know what you're eating or something right. like that?
Because, but then you yeah. could just make like you make sole veronique with peeled grapes and then people have to eat it with their hands blindfolded and you tell them that it's eyeball. And
yeah, exactly. Okay, Alan, we solved it. Next year we'll come up with the actual dishes for it, but that's got to be the concept.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.